Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast, the companion podcast to digitallydownloaded.net. I am Matthew Stainsbury. I'm the editor-in-chief of digitallydownloaded.net, and with me this week we have the regular Matt.
Hello.
We have Harvard, who's replacing Alan.
Hello.
And we have Lachlan, who's an indie game dev with some exciting-looking games on the horizon, and we'll be having a chat about those in a bit. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, everyone. Glad to be here.
Good to have you on. All right. So we might jump to some music and then come back and start the conversation. Was a track, a Hatsune Miku track, Tell Your World, which is one of the better ones out there, and a really good track to play in the rhythm games as well. Okay, so this week we thought we'd start off by talking about a topic that's of quite a lot of interest to people who are into the whole games as art scene. This year, we've seen quite a few of, I guess, what you can call anti-games come out. These games are kind of, they break an awful lot of rules about game design and do so to, explore the nature of game design. We're talking about games like Daydreamer, I think that's the name of it, Daydreamer. Daydreamer, and My Name is Mayo, which Matt recently reviewed and had a great time with. Matt, what are your kind of thoughts? I mean, firstly on My Name is Mayo, I know we've got your review and it's in depth and all of that, but you obviously really enjoyed the game, or anti-game as such. What are your thoughts about the emergent genre?
I think it's really interesting. I think we're starting to see some developments in that space. Obviously, with My Name is Mayo, is my main recent exposure to that. I think it's just interesting seeing developers doing this kind of thing where they are just throwing out the rule book and, in a sense, critiquing the whole medium in that process, which I think is important, and maybe people will learn something from that. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I guess the thing is that, you can't really have a medium be an art medium without having some kind of method for artists to be self-referential and looking at, their space. If you look back at the visual arts, you've got everything from Dadaism to Surrealism and various other movements that kind of explored this idea of breaking down what actually makes a work of art, and why we enjoy these works of art. It's interesting that the game industry is only just starting to get those now. It'll be interesting to see how people respond to them over the longer term. But they're certainly weird. And I mean, there's probably the most popular example, or the one that people remember because it was fairly high profile, was, what's it called? Little Inferno, I think it was it? The one about burning stuff in a fireplace?
Oh, yeah, the one by Tomorrow Corporation.
Yeah, that's the one. That's probably the most high-profile example of an anti-game that we've had so far. You're kind of sitting there not really doing much with a lot of these games. With My Name is Mario, you're literally just clicking it. It kind of reduces games down to the very basic core of them. And with Little Inferno, you're not doing a whole lot. You're just kind of putting stuff into a fireplace and watching it burn, and then starting that process over and over again without that kind of sense of progression that you often expect from games. Did you play that one, Harvard?
Yeah, I played through the whole thing. It was actually a very strange experience because I don't think I'd really played an anti-game of that scale before. Like, normally I just see them as like 5-minute jokes or something, like something that gets to its punchline very quickly. But Little Inferno took quite a lot of time to flesh out this world using mechanics that just, I think for a regular game, just wouldn't make any sense. It distills, you know how you have mobile casual games which gives you timers and makes sure that you're paying attention to the game because every 5 minutes you need to check because your farm's grown a new plant or something. That's the mechanic used in Little Inferno. But it's used in a more sarcastic way. It's like the waiting for the next product to arrive in your fireplace just so you can set it on fire. That was the entire feedback loop for the game. And so it really forced you to question like this entire feeling of waiting and just the new toys you'd be getting, but also like watching this little counter go down. It was just very surreal. It was fun, but it's nothing like anything I've ever tried.
And I mean, it was kind of commentary on the way that people tend to blow all this money on microtransactions to get stuff in, the kinds of games that Little Inferno was satirizing, only for, that money to kind of go up in smoke. It's kind of wasted money once you've spent it in a lot of those games. So I guess that was the kind of commentary that it was making. But yeah, I mean, if you, I haven't played too much of My Name Is Mayo. I've got it there. I haven't had the time to really get into it, but from what I've seen, it seems like it's a game.
It's a very deep and involved game, so you'll need to sit aside a few weeks.
Well, how many clicks do you have to do to get the platinum? It's an awful lot of clicks, isn't it?
10,000.
Yeah, that's a lot of clicks.
Depends how fast you can click. It takes about half an hour, 45 minutes.
I don't think I click that fast. There's a reason I'm terrible at fighting games. But yeah, I mean, it seems like that's a really interesting way of, you know, deconstructing essentially what you do in games. You know, all you're doing in games is clicking. So, you know, to boil it down that far to a ridiculous extreme is certainly something worth thinking about. Whether, I guess the other big question that we need to talk about at some stage is whether these games are actually worth people paying for, which is, which then gets into the conversation, you know, is, you know, do people pay for art? Is art worth paying for? All of that kind of stuff. But yes, yeah. Lachlan, have you had any experience with any of these kinds of games?
Well, I was just going to say, Little Inferno was by the same people that made World of Goo, and it, as a game, it was a really interesting building game. It was kind of like those little matchsticks and glue you'd build at school. And it was a lot of fun and easy to pick up and play. But in between all of those scenes, they still made quite a lot of profound statements about consumerism and sort of how we approach this form of entertainment. And I wondered, Little Inferno being sort of like the whole thing is a parody sort of experience, whether that is more effective than making a game as a core that also has the message, especially when they were charging money for Little Inferno too. Whether it were they better off doing World of Goo with a game rather than a non-game? I just wonder if you're going to make a message, whether you should surely you'd be better off making something people grow and attach to if you're running a business, as opposed to just sort of making a statement. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. I think it's a very good question about the validity of these kinds of games now that we're starting to see more of them. And, yeah, there are some examples of indie games which are more game-ish. The one we haven't really talked about is the one I really enjoyed, which was Daydreamer, which is kind of like a 2D action platformer that just messes with everything that you kind of would know or like about the likes of Mega Man and so on. But yeah, to your point about Little Inferno and My Name Is Mayo, there's certainly a question about whether, you know, it makes sense to do these from a business point of view. But then again, you've got the discussion. I mean, do people don't tend to buy, you know, paintings.
True.
But people go to art galleries. So do we need a platform where people can experience games in a way similar to that, though they can experience paintings?
No, I get what you're saying.
I want to jump in at this point and say that My Name Is Mayo costs a dollar and is worth every penny.
Yeah, I mean, there's that as well. I mean, these games are obviously only ever going to be developed by very small indie teams. I don't know how big the team that made Little Inferno is, but I can't imagine they're too large either. I don't think Ubisoft will ever create an indie game, let's put it that way.
Here's a wake, and a beast now face reality. Never be charity. The enemy, your buddy, covers all society. Damn right, mommy's not here, gonna fight all night. Right here, shadow 10 o'clock direction. Seize the moment, this destroy the nation. Your mind's slow motion, aiming motivation. Get out now, and then I'm arrival. Round up around, spit out, all over. Rhyme like a rolling stone, come in a crowd. Watch out the moon, that this too loud. Give what this sound, if I'm full ground. Surround up, don't ease your pace, cause enemies brutal. Form of the truth, there ain't no truth. You're the only one, one world, one law. Zone shadows all mass destruction.
Oh yeah, da-da-da-down, da-da-da-down. Baby, baby, da-da-da-down, da-da-da-down. Oh yeah, da-da-da-down.
reality. Never be charity. The enemy, your buddy, covers all society. Damn right, mommy's not here, gonna fight all night. Right here, shadow 10 o'clock direction. Seize the moment, destroy the nation. You rise slow motion, give me motivation. Get out now, and stand on the rival. Round up around, spit out, all over. Rhyme like a rolling stone, come in a crowd. Watch out the moon, they diss too loud. Get what this sound, if I'm full ground. Surround up, don't ease your pace, cause enemies brutal. Form of the truth, there ain't no truth. You're the only one, one world, one love. But the battle goes on, shadows all mass destruction.
Oh yeah,
welcome back. That was some good tunes. Okay, so let's talk about a very different subject, but equally radical in many ways to anti-AIMS. Let's talk about Goichi Tsuda, who is kind of top of mind for a lot of people at the moment because Let It Die was released maybe, 2 weeks ago now, when we're recording this anyway. And it's proving to be very popular. A lot of people are really enjoying it. And that's even despite the microtransactions and free-to-play nature of it. But I think for a few people, it would have been the first Goichi Tsuda game. He's been pretty niche for a long time. I think that was the case with you, Matt, wasn't it? That this is your first Goichi Tsuda game?
Yeah. And I must admit, I haven't played a lot. I've only played a couple of hours of it. But yeah, I really like what I'm playing of it so far. And it's very... I don't know, it's very interesting, but also just kind of off the wall entirely, and a lot of things. I wouldn't say they don't make sense, but it's just so...
off the wall humor. Something,
yeah, so bizarre about everything, even the serious moments, if you could call them that.
What would you say kind of stands out the most for you about the game?
Death. Character
Uncle Death,
yeah. just as far as characterization goes, it's such an unusual take on a very, very overplayed common character, especially in games. And yeah, it's just so funny. And in fact, like, all the characters in that little arcade are brilliant.
He walks up and calls you senpai in the first 5 minutes of the game.
Because, yeah, I mean, Uncle Death is probably the most distinctive character. And he's a very, very typical, I guess, Goichi Tsuda kind of character. He loves throwing these kinds of really weird characters into his games. And, yeah, messing with the kind of expectations you'd have for that kind of character. You see Death and you expect a fairly sinister kind of thing. And, you know, then he's falling off his skateboard. Death has a skateboard, and he's falling off it within the first couple of cutscenes. So I think that's a very good introduction for a lot of people to Tsuda's stuff. You should now try and get into Lollipop Chainsaw or Shadows of the Damned. I think you'll find the characters in those games equally interesting. Matt?
Yeah, I watched a flatmate of mine a few years ago was playing Shadows of the Damned, so I watched him playing through a little bit of that. It seemed, I did really enjoy what I saw of that. It seemed very funny and just kind of lots of dick jokes, which I'm sure a lot of people will think, well, that's a bit too lowbrow, but I thought it was very funny.
I mean, kind of fits with the style of the game because it's obviously a grindhouse style game and that's what he was going in for. And I think he achieved that pretty admirably. But yeah, it's a similar kind of, there's a lot of lowbrow kind of humor in Lollipop Chainsaw as well. Which I guess brings me to the next point about Goichi Tsuda is that a lot of his stuff gets fairly heavily criticized by the mainstream for, I guess, the way it portrays or people perceive it to portray certain themes, especially around women. He got a lot of criticism for Lollipop Chainsaw and Shadows of the Damned and Killer is Dead. And I find it interesting with Suda because a lot of the time, the way that the media portrays him is actually kind of the opposite to what he's actually saying through his games. So, you know, Lollipop Chainsaw is often criticized because it has the sexy cheerleader trope and all that kind of stuff. But in reality, it's actually deconstructing that trope and satirizing it. And not so many critics picked up on that. I know that you're a big fan of that game, Lachlan.
I didn't really... I mean, I saw all the criticism that came out for Lollipop Chainsaw. I remember seeing the announcement trailer and my instant reaction was... That's fantastic. It's No More Heroes, but you play as a cheerleader and it looks great. And then all of the criticism came up. And while I can understand a lot of it, it doesn't really feel like that was his intention. It feels like he's got, at least with Lollipop Chainsaw, while she was pole dancing and wearing a cheerleader outfit, it didn't really feel like she was super sexualized in a way that, like, that was all that she existed for. She was a powerful character. She was a lot of fun. She had a boyfriend on a chain, and it sort of, it did feel more like a deconstruction rather than, I guess, as an example, Final Fantasy recently had that Cindy character and very much felt like she existed solely for fan service. Whereas Lollipop Chainsaw, I feel that they came up with a theme and built a game around it rather than creating a character solely for sex, I guess. It doesn't really come across as bad intentions, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, for me, one of the kind of defining moments of that game was just this kind of throwaway comment, but it really stuck out for me. There was this moment where, you know, all around her, she was rescuing her classmates because, you know, there's a zombie outbreak at school, and that's the kind of the intro to the game. And she's, you know, in the school fighting all the zombies and rescuing all the cheerleaders, all the classmates, and they're coming up with the most disgusting kind of comments. Yeah, she's kind of aloof to all of that. She's not really playing to their expectations. And then there's a moment where she starts breaking out in multiple languages, and, you know, her boyfriend doesn't even realize she can speak multiple languages. He can barely speak English half the time. And, you know, she's kind of positioned as, like, more intelligent than and more mature than anybody else. In the game, which
she was the only one to survive the apocalypse and such. She was resourceful too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And she is obviously the best fighter out there. She's obviously a really interesting character. And I find it really amusing because the writer of that game was James Gunn.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Since he wrote Lollipop Chainsaw, he's obviously gone on and done Guardians of the Galaxy, which is kind of universally praised for the way it treats its female characters. So, you know, the more you know, I guess.
Never know that.
Yeah, it's the only game I think he's worked on, so it's fascinating. I don't know how that happened. I think it's pretty cool.
So goes from Scooby-Doo to Lollipop Chainsaw to Guardians of the Galaxy. He's had an interesting life.
Interesting career path. I guess hopefully that opens the door down the track for Goichi Suda to work with some other film directors. I'd love to see him do something with Quentin Tarantino. That would be...
Oh, they'd work well together because Suda loves the over-the-top violence. That could work.
Yeah, Matt, we're just talking... You know, they thought the two styles would work very well together because they... I don't know, they're both artists that kind of do their own thing. And so I was arguing that maybe it wouldn't work so well, but I haven't played Shadow of the Damned, and apparently Suda and Shinji Mikami from Resident Evil did just really great work on that. So I guess it could be something exciting to see.
Yeah, Shadow of the Damned is an interesting game. It was, you can see throughout the entire thing, you can actually feel it as you're playing it, that EA, who was the publisher, was really holding back what Suda wanted to do with it. It's clear he wanted to take it much further than he did. And you can tell it was the publisher. And I've spoken to Suda a couple of times. I've met him a couple of times at TGS and for various interviews. And yeah, when you talk to him about Shadows of the Damned, he's very clear that, you know, this was a collaboration with EA, and he's subtly shifting the blame for anything that, yeah, I don't think they'll be working together again somehow.
It was a good game, though.
It was a very, it's probably the most refined game, I think, of Suda's in terms of actual gameplay.
Yeah, something distinct about his style, and especially in Let It Die, is it's, and Lollipop Chainsaw, is it's very clunky, but in a way that's kind of charming. It kind of suits it quite well that, because the violence is so over the top, it just sort of, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but when you're playing his games, you can tell you're playing a Suda 51 game.
Yeah, yeah, I think I would agree with that just in my limited experience with Let It Die, is I find it quite difficult to play just in terms of on a purely mechanical level. I need to need to be really in the right kind of headspace to go through that, but I don't think it would, I think something would be lost if it was more polished and more refined.
Yeah, I think another good example.
I see a little press that compares the gameplay of Let It Die to Dark Souls, and just kind of like that slow combat. I know that everything gets compared to Dark Souls nowadays if it's a bit slowed down, but what do you think of that comparison specifically for a Suda game?
I think it's a pretty poor comparison. The thing about Dark Souls that makes Dark Souls such a great game, series, is that it's so carefully put together. You know, the level design of Dark Souls tells a story all in itself. The subtle kind of moments that you come across when you're playing, which isn't explicit storytelling, but you know, environmental storytelling, or the layout of the enemies. Everything about those games is so carefully manicured to create specific effects at any point in time that when you try and you couldn't possibly randomize Dark Souls and have it work. And the thing about Let It Die, obviously, is it's roguelike, which is the levels are almost entirely randomized. So Let It Die's design philosophy is the complete opposite of Dark Souls. I think the only comparisons that the reason that people are making those comparisons between the two is that Let It Die is firstly quite difficult and has that asynchronous multiplayer where you're not actually playing together with somebody over the other side of the world, but they're still in your game, invading you like the Red Souls do in Dark Souls. But other than that, I don't understand where the comparisons come between those two games. The series, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Certainly the enemies in the first area of Dark Souls, you're fighting skeletons, very quick-moving enemies. And in Let It Die, not haters, the other name for them, Screamers, the main enemy in that game, feel very similar in that they have lots of quick attacks and they can stun lock you. The difference is Dark Souls has such a big range of enemies, there's lots of surprising things, whereas Let It Die is built entirely around this mostly melee combat with these Screamer enemies. So it feels similar to fighting skeletons, I guess, but as a whole experience goes, it feels completely different to Dark Souls. Especially as you get further in it. I think a lot of the comparisons to Dark Souls are from people who've played the beginning of the game, but as you get further on in Let It Die, it actually sort of evolves from a single-player game to sort of more like a multiplayer Clash of Clans-esque game. All of your stored gold and currency can be raided by other players, and you have to attack other people like that. It certainly... And then once you start doing that, it starts playing music in the lobby and it tonally feels very different. Whereas that first hour, I can understand the comparisons. If you stick with it, it does become its own thing.
What do you think of the comparison between, I mean, what do you think the collaboration between Suda and so this whole idea that Grasshopper is going to start making more online experiences, more multiplayer experiences compared to before, because everything else he's made has been, with the exception of Killer 7, been single player, yes?
Yes, I think so. I think you're right there. Well, I mean, Goichi Suda's company, Grasshopper Manufacture, was acquired 5 or 6 years ago, I think, by Gung Ho. Was it 5 or 6? It's quite a while ago now, but as these things go, it always takes a while for a company, once it's been acquired, to start falling in line with its parent company. But yeah, Gung-Ho is obviously a mobile first publisher in Japan, a very big one. It's the one that produces the Puzzle and Dragon series. And I think you can see what, if you go back to what Let It Die was originally, I can't remember what it was called, Lily something or other before it became Let It Die. And it was originally intended to be in the vein, I guess, of Killer is Dead and Killer 7. And then it evolved into this free-to-play kind of multiplayer-heavy online experience. And I think that's the publisher starting to influence Grasshopper. I think Goichi Suda's a creative enough person that he's never going to allow himself to be completely dictated to, and I don't think that a company like Gung Ho, which is a very smart company, would acquire Grasshopper and then completely rip the soul out of it. So I think there will be some... I think Let It Die is probably a sign of where Goichi Suda is going to go down the track, but I don't think that it's going to become yet another kind of mobile developer if people were worried about that.
Matt, I feel like you had some thoughts about with Let It Die as being a quite deliberate criticism of that whole free-to-play model, even though it is itself free-to-play.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of that. There's certainly elements of that. You can see that, I mean, when I was speaking to Goichi Suda last time, he mentioned he made it quite clear that he has no interest in doing mobile games unless he can do them, you know, his way. And he has quite clearly got some criticisms about the way that these things are monetized and the kinds of experiences that they provide. So I think Let It Die is in some ways a reaction to what is happening in the other free-to-play game space. And that's probably why, in some ways, it's a very distinctive and original and interesting game. Welcome back. Okay, so let's talk with Lachlan about his games. Obviously, that's why we have him on the podcast. It'd be a bit mean if we didn't. So you've obviously got a Kickstarter underway at the moment for Aluna and Brie and the Tentacle Menace, which is a pretty cool title, if you ask me. all due disclaimers, I have backed it because this is ethics and all that nonsense. I've backed the Kickstarter because I really like the look of the game and would like to see it succeed. So, yeah, where did the idea for the game come from? And why is an Aussie developer from regional Australia out there creating kind of Japanese-style games?
Yeah, I'm in the absolute middle of nowhere. I'm in Armidale, which is like 7 hours from Sydney, so... And plus Australia's as remote as it is, so it's, yeah, pretty ridiculous. But Aluna and Brie in the Tentacle Menace is a sequel spin-off to my previous game, Max's Big Bust. I released that game last year in November, and it's been in early access since, and it should be finished in about 6 weeks. I launched the Kickstarter for this next one to sort of build off the peak hype from Max's Big Bus to sort of bring people across was the goal. It hasn't fully worked. The Kickstarter's not doing super great, but it's all good. So I started a couple of years ago. All through high school, I used to make games in Game Maker, but around about the start of the indie boom and Tim Schafer and all that with their Kickstarters and such, I became very interested in indie game development as a, not so much as a full-time career, but I wanted to do it on the side. So I started off making a couple of free games and ended up meeting an artist, and we made a ridiculous game called Gender Bender DNA Twister Extreme, which, built a bit of a reputation for itself on the internet. We sort of had a competing vision for what we wanted to do with it. I very much wanted to make a comedy game. So when I started the next one, which was Max's Big Bust, I started on my own. And rather than working with an artist and collaborating on the story and such, I found a really good website where I could contract Japanese artists because I'm a big fan of anime and even animation studios. I found one that did all the animation for the Guilty Gear games, which I thought was really cool. So I used all the money I got from that first game and sort of went all in to get full creative control. And I've been doing that since. And it's been working out. It's different working by yourself than it is working in a collaboration, but in some ways it's good, I guess. You get to come up with an idea and see it through to the end. Whereas rather than sort of compromising, you still listen to feedback on early access and everything, but it's sort of the avenue of development I've really enjoyed. Yeah. And I get to do some games with anime art styles. And just use, I mean, I still work part-time and everything, but just being able to use money, I guess, to fund these games is, really rewarding for me.
Yeah. So why visual novels?
It's not so much visual novels as a genre that I like. I've played a couple of visual novels I really enjoyed. I liked the Zero Escape games, and I quite liked, even Persona did a couple of visual novel spin-offs, the Persona 4 Arena. Well, it was a fighting game, but all the story was visual novels, and I enjoyed those. But on the other hand, there's been a lot of other visual novels that I haven't super loved, like Clannad and such. When I went into making Max's Big Bust, and it's the same approach I'll be doing for Alluna and Brio, I was actually inspired more by the Mass Effect series, especially the second one, because... in that game, it's got a core storyline from start to finish. And while there's optional side quests you can do, so you don't feel like you're being railroaded down, whereas it's actually quite a guided experience. It's got a beginning, middle, and an end. But you've also got these optional events where you can do the loyalty missions with other people and sort of form relationships. And I really liked that. So when I went to Max's Big Bust, I was inspired by 90s buddy cop movies, or 90s, 2000s, like Rush Hour and such. So I came up with the beginning and middle and the end, and I sort of approached the decision points around hanging out with these other characters so that each get their own little story arcs and you could choose who to hang out with, which is a bit different to other visual novels where generally they've got a bit of a shared path at the start and then it just locks it in to another love interest, whereas I just wanted to, I guess, have all these scenes with these characters, so you sort of, I guess, not so much becoming friends, but just having enjoyable moments throughout it. And making it a visual novel worked really well. But on the other hand, I feel that sometimes if you play these visual novels for hours and hours, it can get a bit draining. And I've been a big fan of RPGs like Persona and such, so that's why I'm making an RPG next, so I can intersperse all the dialogue sections with combat.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, because I really like visual novels, but I, at the same time, I can't play them for huge bursts of time at once.
They're so like long.
With other games. But I'm just curious on that. What if you're okay to share that? What you're using to build your games?
Oh yeah, no worries. I used to use Game Maker. And I got really fluent and proficient with it because I used it for like 10 years at school. But they updated it so that you couldn't make visual novels with it anymore. They limited the file size and very much shifted to mobile games. So you used to be able to store your resources in folders like you would in any other engine. And they just stripped it away completely because you only need 20 megabytes to make a game. Go make an Android game. So I dumped that and I jumped to Rempy, which was the free visual novel engine. And it's very easy to do. And I figured it out in like a week. Still gives you all the control and it's got all the built-in story stuff. And I was able to actually use my knowledge from GameMaker to sort of change the way the engine worked. With Gabudinate, Gender Bender, the first game, one of the stories, the artist was sick for... they weren't sick, they were... It was a combination of sick and a broken computer for a three-month period and they couldn't make any art assets. So I made a character... Something's fallen over. I made a character who could shapeshift into all of the pre-existing character assets and actually made sort of a monkey. Yeah. It was a stroke of genius. I saved the day in the last minute. And I built this sort of adventure game in Rempy. So you'd have a world map, you'd click where to go, who to talk to and who to shapeshift into. Very much inspired by Monkey Island and those sort of things. So I was able to use all of that puzzle stuff and then work it into Max's Big Bust. So in Max's Big Bust, you play as Max, who's a police officer, and at certain points in the game, there's a murder mystery, there's a theft scene, and you have to figure out who the culprit was. And I was able to get adventure game elements such as an inventory and looking at the list of items, looking at your list of suspects and alibis and such. So even though it's not a traditional RPG gameplay or anything, there's still fun diversions in there, and I was able to do that with Rempy. But the problem with Rempy was I started to make an RPG in it because I got a bit carried away with all of this stuff and started to have problems with other computers, so I'm now switching to Unity for the next one.
So, I mean, one of the things that's obviously very standout about your game is that, or games, is that they are super fan service-y in style, in visual style. There's obviously also a lot of controversy about fan servicey games at the moment in the mainstream media and so on. So I guess I wanted to ask you, have you encountered the robust criticism that fan servicey games get? And yeah, why did you decide to do that when you knew that it might put people off the games?
I haven't got a huge amount of criticism for Max, actually. The reviews would have been really good. I haven't really had any of those SGWs hunting me down on anything of that ilk. It's been wholly positive. And I think the difference is, I was talking about it earlier with Suda, is I don't really have a malicious intent. What I wanted with these magical girls was basically to just have a whole bunch of cool outfits. I really like cosplay at conventions and such. And even though that there are these fan servicey outfits, I just like the fun of it, I guess. And I like characters that look cool and interesting while they're fighting. A lot of it is creative decisions made by the artist, but I absolutely love what they've come up with. I can understand that while people would be upset, but I feel that there's not any ridiculous fan service character. Like, for the sake of fan service, these are just characters who have ridiculous outfits. Yeah. Because everyone loves Sailor Moon growing up. So you got to pay tribute to it.
I wanted to ask, with your game being released on Steam and with kind of this visual novel boom that we're having on Steam lately, do you find that as an Australian developer, it's easier to make your work more known, like to have a more distinct style compared to everything coming out of Japan?
Yeah, when I started, there wasn't actually that many visual novels on there. There was, I think... when I launched my first game, there was about 20 or so, and it was mostly a couple of Japanese games. There was Christine Love, she had a couple like Hate Plus and such, and then the Winter Wolves had a lot, and then the Sakura Spirit boom happened, and then a million clones popped up. I think the difference is that when I write my games, generally, and a lot of Australian developers who make visual novels do this too, they'll set it in a foreign location. A lot of games are set in Japan or America sort of to appease the audience. Whereas Max's Big Bust is set in Axon City, which is a fictional city, but it's very heavily just a carbon copy of the Gold Coast, which is where I've gone a lot as a kid and grown up, not so much grown up there, lots of holidays there and lots of aspects of Sydney are in the game, and it's very, very Australian and in your face. I don't compromise on Australian spellings of words. I get a million bug reports that I haven't used a Z in words like commercialization, or there should be a U in color. And what's a dim sim? They don't sell those at Chinese restaurants, which, as I found out from game development, they're actually an Australian dish rather than Chinese, which I had no idea about. So you learn all sorts of things. But yeah, and I think it's sort of hard to stand out from these other games because of the way they sort of handle traffic on Steam recently. It sort of had a bit of a shift to this community focus. So if you've got a cheaper game for like $5 and you get 100 reviews, you're going to get higher Steam visibility than a more expensive game with less reviews. They sort of seem to be prioritizing these shorter experiences. So it's hard to stand out initially, but once people start playing, they realize, oh, this is so Australian. I'm enjoying the ridiculousness. And people talk about thongs and they're wearing, rather than the swimsuit, it's the shoes and stuff. And they sort of like the Australian culture because no one else is really doing it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't actually played your games yet, I must admit. I apologize for that, but my PC doesn't do anything. but yeah, I'd love to see that. I think it'd be really interesting to see how a game that looks so distinctively Japanese would mesh with the Australianisms.
A lot of the backgrounds are actually based on Sydney. I work with Indigo Line Animation. They did the animated cutscenes, but they also did the backgrounds. And the way they make backgrounds is they work off, I mean, a lot of anime does it as well, but they work off real world photos and locations, and they'll trace over and edit them to sort of base it on a real location. So there's a train station in the game that's very heavily based on Central Station in Sydney, and I had to get a rundown suburby area which I based on the house I grew up in Sydney on. I got the photo off Google Maps and they worked that in there, which is a little Easter egg that no one but me got. And I even base stuff around the town I live in now. A lot of the characters' last names are based off schools that I've in the area. If you're an Australian, I mean, the school one's a bit trickier unless you live in this middle of nowhere town. But yeah, once you start playing, you're like, oh, I recognize that beach. It's distinctly got the surf life-saving flags and stuff. It sort of starts to show itself the more you play. Because in Japan, they've got all these games set in a high school and people sort of find it interesting that it's this foreign location. And I'm hoping that I can do the same sort of thing to the American audience, who are most of them, like, oh, it's Australia, it's different than an American high school sort of setting. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of my favourite visual novels of recent years has been Root Letter, which was released maybe about a month ago or so. And it's based in regional Japan. And, you know, it takes a lot of its areas and names and so on from actual people and places in that town. Seems very foreign to us, of course, because most of us would never have even heard of these places. But for the Japanese, I think it would be quite interesting because it would probably be more familiar to them. At least they would have seen it on TV, if not been there themselves. So your Kickstarter's just shy of $13,000 and is looking for $30,000 with 15 days to go.
Yeah, it's not looking ideal. This is the third crowdfunding attempt I've run, and this one's, it's sort of struggling, but I feel the problem's more with Kickstarter as a whole. I mean, not the platform, but I mean people's attitude to Kickstarter. Mm. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I've backed a number of games that have just not delivered at all. Said, oh, we've run out of money, there's no game. Like Sea Lark, for example. I'm so excited for that, and then nothing. So I think people are less trusting. So I just want to make it clear, the game I'm working on, I still fully fund it myself. So I'm using the sales from the previous game. So I'm just going to have to take a little bit longer and slow things down and change the budget around a bit. But I'm still absolutely going to release the game, even if the Kickstarter fails, which it looks like it probably will. I'm not losing too much sleep over it. I feel that I've done all I can, and it's just the way the world's moving.
Yeah, that was my question. I mean, as long as the game still comes out, I guess, from my perspective, it's all good. But yeah, it's a bit disappointing that the Kickstarter doesn't seem to. But you never know. There might be a big rush at the end. You know, once everyone listen to the podcast, it'll go over 30,000 easy there.
100,000.
So, have you ever considered bringing these to console as well, or mobile devices?
I've actually looked into it. The thing that appealed to me a lot is sort of the Sony platforms. Because the problem with launching it on Nintendo is that while these are safe for work games, it's about adults and relationships, and I feel it'll be hard to sort of find the right sort of audience. Whereas
Nintendo doesn't like Nintendo doesn't like the exposed cleavage anyway.
No, they don't. It's really not that bad, but I can see it running into issues. Whereas but the platform I really liked was PS Vita, but there's a couple of problems with that. Is that it's a fantastic console, but not a whole lot of people playing it. I mean, I think if I was able to get it out right now, there'd still be an audience for it. But I feel that in a year's time, it would be a hard sell because, I mean, I know for myself that I've been playing it this week because I got Shantae and I've been loving that. But I haven't really been playing it as much as I used to years ago. And I feel that if you couple in the licensing fees, which are quite expensive, I mean, Australia alone costs like $1,400 to license the game, and you have to do that for every single region you release in. So it's PS4 would be interesting, but I feel that these sort of games work well on a handheld. He's hoping that Sony secretly announces a PS Vita 2 in the next couple of months. But yeah, fat chance of that happening.
We had a talk about the Vita, what was it, a week ago or so, 2 weeks ago, a brief one. And yeah, I think anybody who likes Japanese games likes the PlayStation Vita. And then everybody who likes Japanese games realizes what a tragedy the Vita was, that it should have done a lot better than it did for reasons, which is disappointing. Anyway, just one other quick question before we wrap. What are the chances of getting DD, our mascot, onto one of your games as a guest character?
Well, it's something to look into. I've already used up all of my budget on the character sprites at the moment, but I'm sure we can throw in a reference to the at least a text reference I can throw in there. Maybe one of the characters.
We've got all the character art.
Tell you what, they've got an in-game phone. I dare say I could have them quickly checking a digitally downloaded news article at one point, reviewing some fictional game. Because I've got a little in-game video game system I'm working on. We'll be able to play little arcade games just as a little distraction. So while I'm learning the ropes in Unity, I'm saving all my little projects so I can work them back in. So I'm sure I can work something in.
Awesome. That's all I wanted to hear. All right. Well, I think that's probably everything we've got the time to talk about right now. Best of luck with the game. Hopefully the Kickstarter sneaks through. If not,
that's all good.
Yeah, looking forward to playing it anyway, assuming I can get a PC between now and then. Best of luck with future games down the track.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And thank you. Always, Matt, for joining us, and thanks for jumping in to replace Alan Harvard. And with that, we'll sign off for this week.